Jay Smooth, and welcome to The Life Unexamined Is Not Worth Living. And we are on episode 7, Pick to Survive. Now, before I get started, you all can find me on Spotify and Apple, and there all of y'all can follow and subscribe to my podcast. Also, I ask that you please take the time out to leave me both a rating and a review. Follow me on IG at the_life_unexamined_podcast. And there I'll be sharing some video content of me discussing various topics that I talk about on my episodes during the week. And I'll also be sharing my words of the day to keep y'all actively thinking. And please visit my website, examineourlives.com, where you can find information about my podcast, information about myself. You can find information about guests that I have on my episodes. I have some blogs that I'm putting together as well. And if you want to reach out to me, you can hit me up on my website. Any suggestions, feedback, any questions that you may have, please don't hesitate to ask. And if it makes it easier for y'all, you can also leave me a voice message on my website. And who knows? I may end up playing a message on one of my episodes. With your consent, of course. All right. So let's get back to business. And today I have a special guest, a very strong woman who's been through a great deal of trauma, a great deal of loss, relationship issues, but she's here today, she's persevered, and she's here to tell her story, not only with her voice, but she also has written a book called Pick to Survive. And this woman also has a master's in organizational leadership and a master's in social work. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Gwendolyn Taylor.
Good evening.
Thank you for taking the time to be on my platform. I'm very happy to have you.
I'm happy to be here.
Before we get started, you're definitely going to have some time to talk about your book, talk about the reason why you wrote that book and where you are today. But with every episode that I have where I have a guest on, I always start with the beginning, the foundation. So please tell my audience, what was your foundation? What was your beginning? When did you figure out who you were and the person that you were going to become?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Right off the top of my head, who am I? I'm a mother. I'm a woman. I am a professional. I'm a teacher. I'm a social worker. I am a minister. I'm a lot of things depending on who you're asking. I'm a supervisor. I'm a director. So depending on who you're asking the question to, they may say that I am a lot of things. So I do. I wear a lot of hats. I'm a sister. I'm an aunt. I'm a caretaker. And all of these things make up who I am. And all of these things has built my foundation from a young girl to the woman I am now. I'm all of these things. I have embraced all of these things. And I guess as we get further along, well, these hats are not easy to wear, and sometimes I wear multiple hats at one time, but I thank God that I'm alive, that I can wear them.
So you started off by saying that that was an excellent question, and it's also a loaded question. It is. It can be a very difficult question for people to answer, but you gave so many different answers, and I tell people all the time that there isn't just one answer to who you are. It could be 10 things, it could be 15, it could be 2 things, 20 things, whatever. It doesn't matter. But the fact that you're able to answer that tells me, and I know this from reading your book as well, but this tells me that you put in a lot of time to reflect on who you really are, and your experiences and your wisdom have helped to shape you to who you are and the woman that you are today. So that was really dope. That's a reflection of the work that you put in, and it shows because you're able to answer that so easily.
Yeah, I can answer it easy, but it's not always easy to be or do. My thing is I push forward and I push past it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So can you start with your upbringing, where you're from, where your family's from? You know, when did Gwen become Gwen?
When did Gwen become Gwen? Okay, so my mother, she's from Mississippi, and she's actually one of 16 children. My father's from Georgia. Both my mom and dad, they migrated to New York where they met. My mother had already had 5 children before she met my father. So believe it or not, me and my siblings, we all share different dads, and 7 of us all together, but the same mom. And growing up like in the 80s, 90s, I was born in the 70s, it was an interesting time. And, you know, the notion of a man meeting a woman who has kids already and teenagers at that when he met her is a story in itself. But I think that's what kind of shaped me, because I'm the last of seven children. So when my father came along, my sisters and brothers were teenagers. They were young adults. I was the baby of the family. And if you heard my sisters or my brother say it, they'll say, oh, you were spoiled and you got your way. And actually, I don't believe any of those things are the truth. But it was just a very interesting time as far as where do I fit in a house full of kids already? And then this man who's in this household, he's not anyone else's father but mine. What that felt like, what that was like for me was volumes. And I didn't even understand that until I got older, what that meant for a man to take on a woman with five children back in the 70s and the 80s. That's huge, right?
It is.
Or even what that meant as for my mom, who was a single woman with five kids, right? So we know all the words and things that people use when they see a woman who has a lot of children, and then growing up and being in that environment. And when I became older, I asked my mom, like, Mom, why all of us have different fathers? Like, what was going on? And she was just really simple. She said, well, if one man couldn't provide and take care of me, you know, didn't treat me right, I had to move on. And I was like, that says a lot. And she actually had her first child when she was 18 or 19, and she lived in Mississippi. And she was married to a very abusive man. And back then, she got married at 16 because in this, you know, where she grew up in Mississippi, if you were even dating a man or looked at a man, that means you had to marry him. So she wound up marrying very early. And it taught me to be very careful, because the woman she was at 18 with her first child, she was a totally different woman at 40 when she had me, you know? And so sometimes we're very quick to judge women, like, how did you know? Why do you have so many kids and what's going on? It's like my mother lived many lives, and through her living so many lives, it shaped me into the person that I am, into the woman that I am. We grew up in Brooklyn. We always lived like in a private house. My mother worked. She was a home attendant. My dad worked in the Bronx. He worked in a factory. And as far as I can remember, I had working parents, right? What they would consider the working poor, because I didn't know we were poor. If they went to work, we ate. We had a good old time. Things that we think now, like as a social worker, that was tragic. I'm like, yeah, our lights got cut off all the time. Like, it wasn't a big deal. When the lights went out, that meant we was having a party. We grabbed some candles from underneath the sink. You know, my mother would play some music. I had no idea, like, this was like a situation. When there wasn't a lot of food in the house and we wanted Chinese food, my mother would go in the kitchen, be like, I'm going to make y'all some special Chinese food. And she would get some rice and put some soy sauce in the pan. And we had Chinese food, you know, on Christmases. We never seen like a bad Christmas, because somehow, some way, we woke up in the morning and it was just presents everywhere. So I had a really great childhood growing up. You know, there wasn't any like crazy drama or trauma that you see today in so many lives. It was a lot of colorism growing up, right? So I'm dark skinned. And so I did deal with that, like being a darker person in my family, you know, and I say this a little in the book about the names, Blackie, Black Girl, Black, everything was black, you know, everything was black. And I felt like, you know, I didn't even know I was black till so many people said you're black. And I was like, oh, okay, that must be something. But we were very loved. There was a lot of love in my home, despite my father only being my father. And that's only my lens. I'm pretty sure if some of my siblings told the story, they would, you know, paint you a totally different picture. Because as far as I can tell, everything was good, you know? So it's just interesting how people have so many perspectives. But, you know, we were Brooklyn kids. It was like Crooklyn, the movie Crooklyn. It was just like up and down the stairs, getting my hair braided on the stoop, playing double dutch, all of those things, Red Rover, all of that. That was my childhood. It was great.
So then now, let's pivot on to when you started to get older, let's say your teenage years, into adulthood. Talk about that a little bit, and talk about if that's where maybe things started to, because I know you just said that when you were younger, everything was great. Even if y'all didn't have a lot, but you had, and you were young, you going through everything and you're just enjoying it, right? Like you said, you didn't go through trauma like that when you were younger, like a lot of people have gone through trauma when they were younger and being around dysfunction, you know what I mean? So now let's pivot over to those years and when that started.
So teenage years, it starts to change the tide, right? Things start changing. You start really coming into yourself and you start asking yourself a million questions. That's the real, who am I at 13, 14, 15? Who am I? What is happening in my body? What's happening around me? I think that for my teenage years, it was probably around 15 and 16. That's when I really started discovering racism. I went to school in Brooklyn. I went to two high schools, right? And I always considered myself a bright person, but you wouldn't know it because I was kind of quiet. And when you're quiet and you're in school, you don't get a lot of attention. And I wasn't in the best of schools. I went to Sarah J. Howell. I went to Tilden at the time. And those schools was off the hook. It was crazy. It was rough. And again, I was quiet. I was a quiet girl. I was coming from my block where I had a lot of fun and getting on the bus, on the B7. And it was crazy. It was like, what's that, Lean On Me? Kids would be fighting on the bus. I remember my first day at school, my very first day at school at Tilden, I was scared. I'd never seen so many people. I didn't know it was a difference between Jamaican people, Haitian people, Caribbean people. I just thought we all was black until I got to Tilden. And I was like, oh, people started speaking in dialects and tongues I never heard. And I don't know if they were gangs at the time, but they were definitely groups. I couldn't define it. And I remember being in this big picture. I was in the auditorium and they made all the freshmen come in the auditorium. And I was nervous and I was standing against the wall. It was a bunch of guys. And they were like, you know how to shoot dice? And I was like, no. And so they were like, come over here. You know, and I learned how to shoot dice in school. And the lunchrooms, I remember when we went into the lunchrooms, I always thought high school would be like Sweet Valley High, but it was very much like Rikers Island or something. It was like bars on the window. It was glass.
Right.
The lunchroom was real loud. And I was scared. I used to be scared to go to the lunchroom. I wound up getting a boyfriend with an S in high school. Didn't know about what abuse, like what we see abuse now. Right. So they would come to the class and be like, come out the class. And I would just walk the halls with them, be kissing in the hallways, getting felt up in the hallways. I don't think I put that in a book, but that's what was happening.
Nah, I definitely don't remember reading that in the book.
You know, like I was totally lost. And it's so funny because I remember, I think it was abuse. I'm not going to mention the name, but he would throw me up against the locker and then kiss me real hard and say really bad things to me. It was funny, or even if it wasn't funny, I didn't know what to do. I had bigger sisters, older sisters. We didn't have conversations. We didn't talk about boys. And I grew up in a kind of a religious household. So we didn't talk about boys. If you talked about boys, that means you was fast. You know, my mother used to say, don't let no boy put their hands in your britches. That was the sex talk. I didn't even know what that meant. I was lost in high school for maybe the first year. I was in the wrong class every day. In wrong classes, like totally not prepared, totally lost, just in the system, just showing up in the system. And when I found out that you can leave school, that's what I started doing. So my mother would send me to school, and then First Spirit, I would leave school because it was so crazy. They set a girl hair on fire one time. They used to set the halls on fire. It was like pandemonium every day. Every day, it was like crazy. And I didn't know what to do, so I just left. I would go, and I would just leave. And then that was school, and that was high school when I was there. And then on the block, I always had boyfriends, right? It's very interesting. But not boyfriends in the sense of I just like boys, right? I had a boyfriend in jail. I don't even know how that happened, you know?
A boyfriend in jail.
Just real, real wild and crazy. And then, again, they used to say, oh, you know, I was very insecure about my look because I was very tall. I was very slim. And so, you know, people called you names, you know. I think they called me a little bit of everything. I used to go to the corner store and they used to say flaca. And I was like, what's that?
Yeah, flaca in Spanish is skinny.
And I had no idea. you know, what they were saying. And then also, too, when, you know, you see this whole Me Too movement. You know how many people I could sue because I didn't know that necessarily what guys would rough you up and throw you up. And every time you walk past them, somebody will touch your butt, grab your breath. And this was right. This was daily. Follow you home in their cars. And a lot of it was also not. I was very naive. Very naive. But I wasn't promiscuous. I was curious, which is very different. As a teenager, I was very lost. Completely lost. Had no idea what was going on. I was just wake up and just be. But not bad enough to like have attention drawn to me, but not good enough to be in a, like a gifted or talented school where people are raving after me. I was kind of caught in the middle and I was very unnoticed. And so when no one noticed me, I just kind of just meshed into the regular everyday norm. And so that's how my teenage years were. Just unnoticed. I was invisible.
Yeah.
Very invisible. To my family, my older sisters, they were doing their thing. My brothers was kind of had girlfriends out of the house. I was invisible.
Right. So I want to ask you a question. When you were talking about with your mom and she had like different boyfriends and different things like that, do you think that played any type of factor into when you grew up in like your teenage years and when it came to guys and all of that? So I know that you said that your dad was in your life, and I get that. But as far as even like when you said that in your household, and this is pretty typical for religious households anyway, they don't talk about sex and they don't talk about how you should maneuver when it comes to relationships, sexual interactions, protecting yourself. There's not a lot of talk about that at all. It's basically just like a taboo. Sex is for marriage and that's it. I'm 36 years old, but I come from an old school family. My family's from the South. My grandmother, my family, they're from South Carolina. So I know, and she was very religious, pardon me. And I know how it was. Like, they didn't talk about stuff like that. Do you think that the lack of education when it came to those things at that time, that played a factor into that when you were in your teenage years, when, like you said, you were kind of lost and you were just kind of like just going through the motions?
Yeah, like my mom, we didn't have talks about sex. You know, you were considered to be hot or fresh. You know, get out that boy face. No one was really dating. You just weren't supposed to have a boyfriend. That was it. You don't have a boy in the house. You don't have a boyfriend. No one dared talk about condoms or sex or intercourse. I had no idea about puberty. The conversations just didn't exist. And even for my mom, by the time I came along, she was already married. It was just only my father. I didn't even realize until I got older that he wasn't their father. And you know, even though I saw other men, I wasn't making the connection. One, because my father treated everyone like he was their father. And my father didn't do a lot of talking. That was the other thing. He might have said all of 10 words to me in his lifetime. But my mother she was everything in the house. She ran the house. And we did not talk about sex. My sisters at that time, my sisters who were closest to me, they were already in church. And they wore jean skirts, prayer caps. They would have considered me the wild one, even though I wasn't sexually active, but I wasn't in church. No one actually really talked to me too much about anything. No one asked me about my interests. No one really asked me about school. I was kind of raising myself for a very long time. And again, I guess my mother was worn out. Like, she had raised the kids. I was the last one. You know, I was kind of pretty much on my own.
Right.
And so, no, we didn't have conversations. My education came from my friends. When we all got to school or on the block and we would ask each other questions. We didn't have like internet, remember, right? So that wasn't a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. It was different back then.
Yeah, probably had books, went to the library, looked at the pages of your body, and we thought that was dirty. If you saw a naked woman, you'd be like, oh, look at she naked. Health sex education classes was like taboo. There was no education. People were getting pregnant because they were fast. And that's all the words we knew. You fast, you nasty. No one ever said about anything about a condom. Didn't happen.
So when you now move into adulthood, because I know that you had a son, your first son. What age did you have your first son?
I was 24 years old when I had my first son, and I met a guy and I fell in love. think I've only fallen in love maybe 3 times in my life, if I could be honest. But I was very much in love with this man, and I got pregnant. And when I got pregnant, I was in school. I was in college, which is another thing. Even going to college, I kind of navigated that system on my own. I didn't know what to do. But I knew right away I wanted to continue my pregnancy. And at the time, I thought that him and our relationship was strong enough that we would be married, and in the excitement about having this child would flourish into marriage and like a happily ever after. I don't know if it's because I'm a Sagittarius, right? So I've always have like big dreams, right? magical thinking, like, oh, this is going to be wonderful. I told you it was like the Sweet Valley High. Like, you know, you meet somebody, you have a baby, you get married, you buy a house. And no, that didn't happen.
Yeah, I'm like the complete opposite of that. Like, I'm very cynical, and I could be very like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. Yeah, that's fine. Like, all right, yeah, all right. You know, I don't really get too high on things, and I'm like kind of like the in the middle type of person. I don't get too high, I don't get too low. But anyway, it's just funny that you said that, because you're like a person that's like, oh, and this is going to be great and spectacular. It sounds good in theory, but let's talk about why that theory didn't come to fruition.
So, for a lot of reasons, it didn't happen because ultimately he cheated. I don't think I've ever said this out loud. He cheated. He had another woman, family, life. I didn't get chosen. I wasn't the person to be picked, and I am dressing it nicely. But I felt like I didn't get picked. I wasn't the person that he wanted to be with. And it wasn't communicated as such. It was communicated, came out really awful and ugly, where you find out that the person who you thought you knew was not the person, and you're left kind of holding the bag. In my case, left holding the baby. And it was extremely devastating at 24. And like I said before, I'm a person of dreams and inspirations. And at that time, I had not finished college. I had not purchased a home. I had not done anything, because I've always felt that you would do these things with your husband and your companion. You know, you would raise your children, you would buy that home, you would go on the vacation. And I was just kind of starting, right? Just graduated really from high school, and I had like a little job and things like that. And so I never see myself outside of what I had imagined. But now here I am, 24, and I have a baby.
Right.
Like a whole person. And he made it evident that it was not what he wanted, at least not with me, because he had started another relationship with someone else. And they, too, had a child.
Okay. So now you're 24 years old. Can I say that that's the hardest thing that you had to deal with in your life at that time? I'm saying at that time, right?
Absolutely. I became physically sick. I became physically sick at the thought of, like, I mean, it's one thing to cheat. It's another thing. Now you have a child involved. And then, like, your whole world comes crashing down really quickly. And you don't have the tools. I didn't have the tools, the resources, the language, the brain, the sense of self-worth to pick myself up, right? So physically, I was sick. You know, my hair started falling out. I remember going to the hairdresser, and she was combing my hair. My hair was just coming out. I was stressed out. I was so stressed out. And I just couldn't understand, like, well, what happened and what's going to happen? How is it going to happen? And it feels like you have the weight of the world on your shoulders. And on top of that, you know, was minimum child support and a lot of back and forth to court. It was awful. It was stressful. It was the worst time. It was the worst thing that I thought that I could ever go through. And it was embarrassing, most of all. It was very embarrassing.
Right, right. So it's funny that you say that at the time you thought that that was like, oh, this is it. This is the worst thing that could ever happen to me. I was in love. Man, this dude, he did me dirty. What else could happen to me? Well, a lot happened to you. So let's get into that. So after that occurs and you have your son, it's you and your son. he's getting older, you're raising him. You know, you're a single mother. You're doing what a lot of single women do. You know, single women are strong. They take care of their business. They got to do what they got to do. But throughout that journey that you have, what were the things that were starting to occur?
So it's so funny. Over the years, so I don't know, I felt like I began to gain, as my son became older, I began to gain a lot of strength. After I finished all the crying and tantrums, like, I can't do it. But I also had very strong women around me. My mom, I had my sisters. I mean, my sisters and my mother, they helped me down. And just finding, I started, you know, really going to church and attending church. And again, it was me finding God in this. And I put myself back in school and I worked. And, it, you know, this notion of you have to do one or the other. I always had three jobs, three jobs individually, like at one time. You know, I've always had my son. My son would travel with me everywhere I would go. So it was just me. It was him and I all the time. And I gained a lot of strength in that.
Right.
And then in between, I didn't do a lot of dating, which was very interesting. I never had a lot of relationships. Maybe I had one following that, I had one meaningful relationship, which was a lot of fun, but ended tragically also because he too cheated. And so it's this common theme. And I guess as we get further, someone asked me, like, how do you keep dating men who cheat on you? What is it about you that these men cheat? And I thought about that. And, you know, as a social worker, now that I can say it, I was like, I would not own that. You know, like, I would not own somebody else's behavior. There's some things that I think that there's some common themes, but ultimately, if somebody wants to be with you, they're going to be with you. If somebody wants to leave and cheat, they're going to leave. There's nothing you can do. But you can look at yourself and say, okay, well, maybe these are some of the things or signs, but I can't make anybody be with me. And, but, you know, in between that, I had maybe two or three relationships in that last a period of time, but all ending with someone cheating.
Yeah. And I agree with you that if somebody wants to cheat, they're going to cheat. It doesn't really matter. It don't matter how good you look. It don't matter what your body look like. If somebody wants to cheat, they're going to cheat. The only thing that I will say, and not in reference to cheating, but I will say that in just even my experiences with the relationships that I've had and, you know, being married and all of that, the person that you choose to be with, though, is a reflection of you, right? So if you have insecurities about yourself, if there's things that's going on with you, your partner is going to be a reflection of that. And that's something that I did learn for sure.
And I do agree with the concept that the person is a reflection of you for the simple fact that the men I dated were like they were kind of together. Right? I wasn't dating no like sloppy guys. Like they were all very confident, maybe overconfident. They all pretty much had big goals and dreams, maybe too big. They all were very nice looking guys, like really like very well put together. They were personable. Like these wasn't like thugs and
yeah.
He's like, you know, I know what I'm attracted to. They and it is a type, you know, they was very much wanted, you know, like if you saw him like, oh yeah, you know, that's a nice looking guy. Like he got his stuff together, you know, he makes decent money, you know, he got goals and like all of those things. It is a theme. It is. I do have a type. And so when you say you attract what you are, yeah, those were mirrors of me, like those high thinkers. I'm confident, but I had a lot of cocky, you know, like I'm the man. But when you attract those type of men who have that type of a stature, and sometimes they feel that because I'm this kind of person, I can have whatever I like and behave however I want to. You know, I remain friends with some people. And one of the things that I've always gotten from relationships was when I say, well, you know, why we didn't work or what happened or whatever. And they'll say, you acted like you didn't need me. You were so strong that I couldn't find a place.
Interesting.
And so just to try my luck one time, I tried to do the whole damsel in distress. I remember I had a situation. I was like, oh, help me. I tried to do it. I tried to be that person, like, okay, let me see. Rescue me, oh Romeo. And to my you know, to my shock, that ain't work either. So I don't know. It's really hard. And then, you know, you hear it. I'm pretty sure you hear it. You see it as Black women, Black educated female women. This is statistics. We have the lowest rate, especially of a certain age. We have the lowest rate of marriages or relationships because of our status and our age and different things like that. So it's not like a phenomenon. It's just like, and even my son is 23, right? I said, well, tell me, what do you think? He was like, Mom, nobody's not dating you. He was like, look at you. What do you want them to do? He was like, you do everything.
Right, right. And you know, it's funny also because I've also heard people say about, you know, African-American women, and they'll say like, oh, they give too much pushback. And they have mouths on them and stuff like that. I've heard this before from many people, right? And then they'll say, like, people from other races, they're more obedient and they don't talk back. They don't do that. But I laugh at that type of stuff because for me, and this is just my personal opinion, I laugh because you're threatened by a strong woman. I'm not saying that that a woman has to push back on everything just to want to fight, but I just mean from the standpoint of you respect her opinion, right? She's intelligent. She has a lot going for herself. She knows how to take care of herself. You can build with someone like that. But a lot of minority men, not all of them, not saying everybody, but even me personally, I'm not like this, right? But what I'm saying is that some of them, they don't know how to deal with a woman who has her own voice. It's difficult. And even what you just said, they think it to themselves, you do everything, so where do I come in? Where do I fit in? But that's why I always say that it's very important to know who you are and what you represent and have a strong foundation, because at the end of the day, if you know what you want, and this goes for both men and women, and now you can come together, have a conversation and communicate. But a lot of times that doesn't happen because it starts with, oh, you look good. You look good too. Then it's like, okay, we just go through the motions. We date, we go out, but it's not anything that's fulfilling. Like, it's not something that has any type of longevity to it. Absolutely. So like you were saying, a lot of those marriage rates and different things like that, they're not great because these people don't even know who they both are at all. They're just getting wrapped up into the superficial, we're having a good time, the good vibes, we're having fun. And there's a lot more to it than that, but I just wanted to say that.
I definitely agree with you. I think it is a lot more, and it's compact, right? So it's not just one particular thing. And that's why I say I can't just put the onus on me. It's because of me. You know, I just think also, too, the other part of that is I also believe when it's your time, and nothing is going to stop that. That person who you're supposed to be with, that man, that woman, if you're supposed to be with them, it's going to happen. You don't have to do a whole bunch of anything. You can actually be who you are. And that's my goal, is to be able to be who I am in a relationship, because I like to talk. I talk a lot. You know, that's what I do, you know?
And that's what it's about. I preach that on this podcast. It's about being 100% unapologetically you. And if somebody don't like you, I said this in one of my episodes, tell them to kick rocks. It is what it is. If they don't like you, so what? You'll be all right.
And then also we have to understand that people have other agendas and other motives and different things like that. And perhaps you with me because I make you look good. So there's a lot of things there to unpack, right? I'm not the only person in a relationship. And I can't even say all my relationships were all bad. Like I said, a lot of my exes, we still have relationships with. I talked to them. You know, it wasn't ending like in tragic, oh, I hate you. It was ending like, you lied, you cheated, and no, I'm not going to do that.
Right.
And I would say again, but then I'm going to talk about my second son.
I was about to get into that. This story and this journey that you have is so deep, because now we get to child number two, but there's a twist to that, and you're going to explain that.
How did you read that?
I mean, I read the book.
You read the book.
Please explain this little, pardon me, little big twist.
So the twist is like a plot twist, right? Right. So the twist of that is, you love who you love. You love who you love. And I think it was interesting. I rekindled my relationship with my son's father because I knew what that love felt like. At the time, I was also living in Harlem. Very interesting time. And my sister had just passed away. Dad had passed away. And I was doing my thing, you know, and then this person comes and you are able to forgive. So it was a lot of forgiveness there. And it's just like, okay, well, maybe this is it, right? Because magical thinking, right? This is it. This is it. You know, you this is going to be it.
And this goes back to that magical thinking that you were talking about earlier before. Everything's going to be magnificent. Yeah. And did everything end up that way? Talk about it.
We had plans and, you know, he had children and I had, you know, his son already. And, you know, I embraced his family, you know, the way that most women do. Like, come on, we're just going to be this one big happy family. And I was so hopeful. And then I got a phone call saying that he was married. Not to the first one.
Right.
So another one. And so it just ended. And so do I stay because of my safe face? You know? No, absolutely not. And so, yeah, it spiraled out of control and the lies and the devastation, right? The difference, though, I must say this, I wasn't 24. That was the difference. And I wasn't devastated. I had years of preparation, which is good and sad all at the same time. I wasn't the same person, but it was awful that I had to be that person. But I was ready, and I was ready to take on whatever challenges that breakup brought, because although I had forgiven, it was interesting that I was a little hard too. But the damage, this is why when we women meet men sometime of certain ages and men come into your life, they'd be so damaged. You'd be like, what happened to you? You know, like, why are you acting so crazy? Because these things that these men experience in their young adult lives or with their moms and all these traumas and issues and things like that. And now you got to bring that into a relationship.
Right.
And some woman has to deal with all of this stuff. And because you have all this baggage that someone else created, they took their baggage and laid it on you. This is why when we were talking offline, it's so important for you to do the work.
Nah, it's a fact. That's a fact. And that's why I always say a lot of us, we grow up in dysfunction. We come from a lot of craziness and we never get help for that. See, and when you don't examine, you don't get the therapy, you don't reflect on your life, you don't get the proper help that's needed, then now you bring in all of that crap into a relationship with somebody else and then they got to deal with your crap. And I talked about this in episode one of my podcast as well. We have all these things going on with us and then we want to bring that baggage into a relationship and then now you corrupting and messing up somebody else's life. It's not fair to you and it's not fair to the other person as well. But a lot of us don't know any better. And we have to break that curse. We really do. And especially us as minorities, we got to break through all of these generational chains and backwards mentalities. Because at some point in time, and I'm not talking about American history, we were kings, we were queens, and we took care of ourselves spiritually, mentally, and we were wealthy. And I'm not just talking about money, I'm talking about mentality-wise. But we got to get back to that, but a lot of us don't know our history. And I just want to say this last thing, too, about your baby's father. His true side came out. He showed you who he was every single time. The first time he showed you who he was, and he did you dirty. Then the second time you wanted to make things right with him, you had another child with him, you wanted both of your children to have their father, and you wanted to have a great life. But once again, his true side came out and he had another family. He was basically living a double life. And once again, chaos, ridiculousness, and everything comes to the light. And I'm not saying that people can't hide stuff from people. Of course they can. There are a lot of con artists out there. I'm aware. Believe me. But he showed you who he was the first time, and then he showed you who he was again the second time. So years went on, but there was no maturity. It was the same dude, the same games, but you were in a better place this time and you weren't affected the same way. You were a single mother for years. You took care of your son by yourself, and you were just in a different place mentally. And that's dope. That shows your maturity and your growth. And people could look at you and say, well, why would you do that again? And rightfully so. That's a logical line of reasoning. But for you, you say, look, I made the decision. It didn't go the way that I wanted, but it was a part of my journey. And I learned from that. And I'm the woman that I am today because of that. And there may have been a lot of heartache in this process, but there's also a lot of power in that process if you embrace it. And with all of that being said, most people will hear all of this and say, all right, this is a lot, you know, this is a lot to deal with in your life. But we're still not done. There's a lot more that has occurred after that.
In 2021, and also in conjunction with me going to school, I also started to advance in ministry, right? So I became a missionary and then a minister and then an elder. Right now I'm an elder in my church. And I went back to school again for my last master's. And as I would begin the year of my last master's degree in social work, right after COVID, I was sick. I started getting really, really sick and I didn't know, you know, what was happening. I felt very tired all the time. I felt very lethargic. My stomach was bothering me, but I kept going to school because I was enrolled in school and doing my regular things. And I figured it was just because of my schedule. You know, I'm running, you know, I got my son, he's in swimming lessons, then basketball lessons, and I have my mom here. You know, I'm like superwoman. So I take care of my mom too. My mom is 84 and I take care of her. And then I had my oldest son here at the time. He was trying to apply to go into the Air Force and he was working. And I wasn't feeling well, but I was still working. And I remember it was my stomach started getting really big, like gassy. Like I felt like I had gas. And I went to the doctor and he gave me some gas medicine. And then I called him back. I was like, that's not working. And then he told me he wanted to refer me to see someone else. But the appointment was like 3 months from the date. And so I said, okay, I'll just, you know, figure it out. And I started getting fevers, all these different things. And on my ordination, as I was getting ordained as an elder, I went to class that morning because I was like, I can't miss class. And then I said, I'm going to leave class and then I'm going to go to the church service. And I did that. And by the time I got to the church service, I was so sick and my stomach was protruding. And I told one of the young ladies, I was like, you're going to have to hold me up while we're in here because I can't even stand.
Wow.
And that's crazy. I managed to get through the service. And then after the service, I told my family, my sister, my son, I was like, I'm going to go to the emergency room because something is not right. By the time I got to the emergency room, and I wound up taking a cab, I didn't drive, which was great. But when I got there, I couldn't breathe. By the time I got there, I'm taking these gas of air. And the nurse said, do you have asthma? And I was like, no, I don't have a history of asthma, bronchitis, or any kind of illness like that. And so she checked me out and she was like, I don't know what's wrong with you. She gave me like, we're just going to give you an inhaler. And I was like, no. And I was showing her my stomach. Finally, they sent me to do a CAT scan and some other tests. And they gave me an oxygen mask. And a couple of hours later, when the doctor came in, he said, Miss Taylor, we see a tumor on your ovaries. And I was like, what? And he was like, yes, you have a big tumor on your ovaries. And we believe it's cancer.
Yeah, hearing that had to be scary for sure.
I couldn't even process the word. And I was like, what do you mean? Like cancer, like, you know, I'm thinking like Sagittarius, Aries, cancer. Like, you know, like, what are you saying? He's saying cancer. I was like, what? You know, and I was like, what are you saying? From there, I called my sister, my mom, and my best friend. And I'm telling them between me gasping. And from that, it was a whirlwind of events. I'll make this short. Following that conversation with him, the next day I had to stay in the hospital. I had what's called ascites fluid had filled up my belly, making my belly protrude, which was caused my lung to collapse. So I had one lung. They took me from, and maybe I shouldn't call the names out, but they took me from a hospital in Queens to another hospital in Queens. And when I got there, I Zoomed my pastor at the time. I Zoomed my sister. I had some people on Zoom, my mom. And I said, listen, I have to have this emergency surgery. I don't know. And the doctors came into the room and he told me what my chances are if it had spread through my body. Because a lot of times the ascites fluid takes the cancer throughout your body, carries it all around. And he says, we're going to see what we can do. And you might have to remove your lung, or we might have to plaster it to the back of your wall, or we might, like, they didn't know how much damage or how much had spread or what would be the result of that. And I went into surgery and I just prayed, and I just prayed, and my pastor, he was praying, and the church was praying. And I went into the surgery, and I remember sitting in the hallway right before surgery, because they got you in this cold room, and I'm on oxygen because I can't breathe. And I wrote Jeremiah and Joshua in my palms of my hands. And all I could do was just pray that I needed to see my children and I needed to wake up. And thanks to God, I woke up, and the surgery was successful. And the first thing I noticed was I had a big chest tube hanging out the side of my chest that was draining the water and the blood and the fluid out of my chest. And then was all bandaged up. They had a lot of, you know, cords and things like that. And they said, well, we went in. They said, we did the biopsy. And according to the biopsy, they didn't see any other cancer. It had not traveled or spread to the lungs. Nothing but the grace of God. I was transferred from that hospital back to the first hospital 2 days later. In that hospital, I waited maybe about 2 weeks before I saw the oncologist, gynecologist, to tell me, okay, you have this tumor. What's going on? At this time, my breathing is really bad.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinning out. I'm getting skinny. I'm losing my functions in my body. Like, it's having implications on everything that's going on. And when I saw the doctor, basically, by the time he came, I'm like 3 weeks already in the hospitals, right? So it's almost a month now. And he said, you know, Ms. Taylor, what you need is a very big surgery that this hospital is not prepared to do. And he was like, I don't know what to tell you, because we don't know how advanced it looks. You have a very advanced form of cancer. And I just couldn't believe it. I was like, wait, what do you mean? I'm going to die? Like,
yeah.
Can't die? Like, I don't even know what that meant. And so a month had passed. I'm still in the hospital. And a friend of mine who worked at my church, who goes to my church, she was in communication with my sister, and we were praying. She was like, you know, I work at MSK. I could say MSK, Memorial Sloan Kettering. And she says, the surgeon here, she says, she'll take your case. And I was like, okay. And she said, can you send me the scans on what they're saying? I started from my hospital bed. I'd say, bring my laptop. I'd have my friend bring my laptop. And I was, every time they did a scan or did a result, I would email it to her. And she was back and forward. And I told the doctor there, I said, I need to leave here to go to MSK so they could do the surgery. He was like, oh, no, you can't leave, because, mom, I got a chest too. I said, no, she says she's going to do it. I got to go. And then he was like, well, pulmonary, got into this whole craziness. They wouldn't remove the chest tube because I could have to walk into MSK because it's a private hospital. You can't transfer. And so he said, we can't transfer you. You have to walk in. And it was this whole back and forth. 2 months now, I'm in the hospital and I'm getting worse.
Yeah, that's bad.
My mom came up to the hospital and she was like, what is going on? You know, at the same time, my sister from North Carolina flew in, because remember, I have a 7-year-old at home. At the time, he was 5 or 6. My best friend flew from D.C. to take care of my son. My sister came in to take care of my mother. I have a whole house of people. Oh, and our supervisor, because I never stopped working. So I'm still running stuff from work and signing timesheets. Maybe my laptop. I got to get these people paid.
Yeah, you definitely are task-driven and focused for sure.
I'm a supervisor and I have a whole program and I have to be on Zooms and meetings. So some stuff I was able to delegate, and then some stuff people don't know what the heck to do. So I'm like, I'll just do it. And the doctors are coming in and out and they're like, what's going on? And I'm not getting better. I'm getting worse. So I know I got to get out of here. I told the doctor, you got to pull the chest tube. And I made an appointment to be at Sloan Kettering. Then the day came, they didn't do it. Another week passed. I made another appointment, and my regular doctor came and he told me to bend over on the bed. He said, I'm just going to pull the chest tube so you can go, because pulmonary won't do it. And it caused a pneumothorax, meaning I had air in my lungs, which put me in jeopardy of my lungs collapsing, because I had now the air from the chest tube got into my chest cavity. Then they signed me up for another procedure forgot the name of it, where they stick a needle in your chest cavity and eject the ear. That didn't work. And so I said, well, I got to go. And I called my son and I said, I need you to meet me at the hospital at 4 o'clock and take me to Memorial Sloan Kettering. And I got out of my bed and I put my sneakers on, whatever he bought me, his sweatshirt and some sneakers I had. And I walked out the hospital and the nurses and doctors are screaming, where are you going? And I was like, y'all gonna let me stay here and die.
Right. Right.
And I got into the cab and we went through the Midtown Tunnel. And that was the first time I was at the hospital in 2 months. And I couldn't stand. I wasn't eating. I couldn't stand. And I said, take me there. And by the time I got to Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital, to the clinic, because I wasn't even in the hospital, I was in the elevator, and they called. They said, Miss Taylor, we're about to close. Are you coming? And when the doors opened, I was standing right there. And the surgeon was there and her team, and they wrapped me up in some blankets because I couldn't even stand. And my best friend was with me, and they transferred me to the hospital. And about a week later, they performed my surgery. And it was a long road to recovery, but I'm glad to say that I'm cancer-free. I was introduced to a support group, National Ovarian Cancer Coalition. It's actually my surgeon's mother who's the chairperson. I've had the opportunity to speak at their convention. Most recently, I had a relapse where they found the small tumor and they removed it. And I am cancer-free, and I'm a 3-year ovarian cancer survivor.
That's what's up. I'm very happy to hear that.
I am blessed. But Jay Smoove, and then within that time, my pastor passed away. And 6 months later, my bishop passed away. And it's just amazing when I'm standing here just in my truth and my humanity and everything I've been through.
100%.
Because I know there's a reason why I'm here. There's a reason why I survive what I've been through, all that I've been through, everything from every bad relationship to every lying man, to every health scare. There's a reason that God has chosen me to survive. And I'm going to continue to do his work until I can't do it again.
Absolutely. And there's one last thing that I want to bring up to you before we get to your book and we wrap this up. Your sister.
My sister who died from breast cancer?
Yes.
In 2010, I think it was 2010, 2011. You know, I have four sisters. I'm the youngest. We're in the living room. We're playing and we're laughing. And my sister was like, look, I have a bump underneath my arm. And we say, bust it. We don't know what it is because right. My family has never had cancer. And so we bust it. And this thing blew up from a little pimple to it took over our whole arm. And when it took over our arm, I'm caretaker. And let me tell you how strategic God was in this. Because when my sister was diagnosed with cancer, at the same time, I was living in Brooklyn by myself, me and my son. My house was broken into.
Yeah, I read that in your book.
So I wound up moving in with my mom because I was scared to go home. But my sister was sick and I wound up taking care of her and being her proxy and her medical provider. And she didn't have insurance. And so she got the minimum care. It was very different from my experience, right? When I had my chemo, they give me a bed and snacks and coffee. She was in the room with like 20 other people and she had awful care. Awful. And she wound up having a mastectomy. And then even after that, when she had a surgery, I went with her to her checkup appointment. And when we got to the room, the doctors came in. It was like, oh, you want to sign the DNR? I was like, what DNR? And it was like, wait, they didn't tell you? And it was like, no, what are you talking about? And they were like, basically, your cancer has spread. And there's nothing else we can do for you. You have like a couple of months to live.
Yep.
And we're like, wait, what? And she was 43, a little younger than me. So you can imagine my anxiety. I watched my sister die.
Yeah.
Of breast cancer. Probably something that could have like went, but when we talk about Black women and statistics and insurance and things like that, things that could have been avoided, things that could have been treatable.
Yeah.
And we can say, oh, it was her time. But there's a lot of injustice and inequality when it comes to women's health care. And one of the things that I did different was when I left that hospital, I was like, y'all not going to let me lay here and die because y'all don't know what's going on. And being able to advocate for yourself, having someone to advocate for you, getting to a place where you're like, and when I got there, they said, we do these surgeries all day. And when another hospital that's a city-ran hospital is like, we don't know what's happening. We don't have the technology. We don't know what's going on. That matters.
Yeah, it does. It does.
You understand? So being a voice to speak out to other people, we took it for granted, me being naive. And it's like, oh, it's just a pimple and not understanding the signs of breast cancer or not having mammograms on a regular basis, all of that stuff. And I watched my sister die.
No, absolutely. And, you know, it's really dope that you have a voice for that because, you know, I talked about this in my second episode, but my mother died from cancer and my mother had breast cancer and it spread to her bones and then it went to her brain. And, you know, once it goes to your brain, you're finished, right? And same with you. Like, I watched my mother deteriorate over the years. Pardon me, I said over the years, over the months that she was in the hospice and hospice care, and it was awful. It's the worst thing that I ever had to deal with in my life. But what you said was important because it could have been avoided. We hope that this story can be used to help people when it comes to cancer and getting all the tests done and making sure that you're good and that you're right. But with all that being said, the cancer was a part of my mother's journey, a part of your sister's journey, and that was their path. And in relation to my mother, she's gone, but I'm here. You know what I'm saying? And I live through her, the only child that she has. So I just want to make her name still stand to this day by doing the things that I'm doing right now, you know, interviewing you, talking to you, different things like that, and just putting positive energy into the world. But let's get to your book, even though, honestly, this whole interview is about your book, because everything that you're talking about, we're basically talking about your book, because all of these in different chapters of your book. And let everyone know where they could find your book, Pick to Survive.
You can purchase Pick to Survive on Amazon, or you can go to my website, GwendolynTaylor.com.
All right. Dope. And now I want you to just explain why you did the book and what kind of takeaways do you want to leave with people after they read your book?
I never considered myself a poet, but I have so much to say. I've always had a lot to say. As a child, I used to journal, I used to write, and I've always had these poems and these words that come to me. And so my book is a collection of spoken word and poems about my life. And I always said I want to be an author. I always want to write. And this is not going to be my only book, but I've always wanted to write. But I couldn't get my book into a story the way that I wanted it to be. And every time I sat down to write the chapters about all the relationship stuff, it didn't come out like that. I found myself rhyming. And I was like, what, am I a rapper? Like, you know, I found myself rhyming my words and singing these songs and things like that. And I said, when I was in the hospital, a lot of my prayers became poetry. A lot of the things, my conversations with God became writings. When I came out and I was doing my chemo, and, you know, chemo is a beast, and I would be in here by myself, and I was like, I think I'm getting it. That it's not just one thing. There's things, there's multiple places where I want to take people on this journey to see how my life has elapsed over a period of time. And I want to do it in a way where it's kind of musical and flows and it's poetic. You know, I want to talk about my relationships and my experiences with men, but not in a harsh, mean way, right? The way I've seen bitter and upset, because that's not what I strive to do, right? But I want to show people, like, I had these experiences, and this is what these experiences taught me,
right?
And so the goal of the book is to really share that, and so you can find yourself anywhere in the book, right? If you're reading the book, you can find yourself in any chapter. You know, I have a poem about, like, you know, just going out with these random guys and, like, all the lies and crazy things that they say and they tell, you know. And it's kind of funny. So it's comical that people can be so crazy. And then I have these tragic stories of losing people, because your life is more than just one thing. And we said it earlier, just when you think, right? Like, I'm nervous about, like, 50 and 60, right? But just when you think, like, oh my God, I went through this. This is so awful. This is, so, you know, God is like, you know what? That made you got it. Boom. Here's something else. That made you got it. Boom. There's something else. And sometimes I feel like I'm a fighter, you know, and I'm shielding and I'm blocking, like Wonder Woman, like these things that are coming after me or coming to be my demise or be my end. And God is just sharpening my tools. He's given me more time. He's given me more power, resources, people. He's placed me with people I would have never met you.
That's a fact.
You know, that I've never thought I would ever meet, or places or arenas. And so the poetry in the book is about that and how we have been selected. If you're reading this book, there's a reason why you're here. On the cover, it kind of shows a field of dead sunflowers. And in the field of dead sunflowers, there's just one standing. And that's us.
Yeah, I like that. I like the imagery behind that.
It's us. It's us. Like, so it's a reason why you're still here. It's a reason why you're doing the thing that you're doing. It's not by mistake. It's by design, and that we have to embrace it. And nothing is too hard for God. And you, even though I have like my magical thinking, because I still believe that, you know, okay, maybe the first three relationships didn't work out. Okay, that was a bust. But I believe that there is going to be this space or this person in these moments, you know, that I'm going to be able to cherish, because it's not the end of my chapter. There's so much more, you know, for me to write about given the time. But I want people to embrace, like, what you do here, it matters. I want to leave a legacy for my children. I want to leave a legacy for my boys. When my sons grow up, I want them to be awesome. I want them to be able to say, that was my mother. That was my mother did that. The reality of time, and I'll share this last thought. When my sister was dying and I would go to the hospital, every time I got off the elevator, it was a huge clock. And the tick, tick became very loud. And it was time. And so the meaning is, my time is very precious, and I don't like for nobody to waste my time.
That's a fact.
What are you doing with the time God has given you on this earth? Are you just letting it tick away? It matters. Leave a legacy.
That's a fact. It matters. And y'all hear that? I talked about this before with y'all, and she is a walking embodiment of someone who has been through the worst situations, and she's still here. She's making her mark. Pardon me. She's leaving her mark. And I said that I'm a walking embodiment of that, everything that I've been through. And we're not the only two people. There's millions of others of people in this world that are walking embodiments of leaving their mark on this earth. So the strength that this woman has shown, the wisdom, the knowledge, the learning, the reflection, the examination, she did that. She put the work in. That's what it's about. And every second, every minute of your life, do not take that for granted. Don't take for granted what you have in your life. And even when you don't have, and I said this before, you still have. When you lose things, there's still things that you still have, and you don't take those things for granted at all. And it's about leaving your legacy, leaving your mark. When we're going, we want to be known for something that's positive, not negativity, or he was known or she was known for all this trash, toxic energy, nothing that builds any of us up, wanting to keep everybody down. It's basura. So I'm going to sign out like this. Those of us that are still here, that are still standing, we still have time. If there's any wrongs that we committed, we got time to right them. Leaving our mark on this earth, we have time to accomplish that. Living a positive life, we have time to do that. Given everything that we have for the greater good, we have time to fulfill that. But again, that takes much examination, scrutiny, critical observation, and reflection. But we are picked to survive. And you can interpret that any way that you want. And I don't know about y'all, but being picked to survive, now that's a definition of a life that's worth living. I want to thank Gwen for taking the time to share her story. And once again, thank you for being on my platform. I'm your host, Jay Smooth. And thank you for listening to The Life Unexamined Is Not Worth Living. And we out of here. Peace.